judgment. Those who have wisdom can understand by means of metaphors. If you come to where there is no possibility of comparison or similitude, how can you explain it to them? Case. Kaoshan asked Elder De, the Buddha's true reality body is like space. It manifests form in response to beings, like the moon in the water. How do you explain the principle of response? De said, it is like an ass looking in a well. Kaoshan said, you said a lot indeed, but you only said 80%. De said, what about you, teacher? Kaoshan said, like the well looking at the ass. First, the ass looks at the well looks at the ass. Wisdom is all-embracing. Purity pervades with abundance. Behind the elbow discerns the seal. In the house, no books are kept. The loom threads are strung, the work of the shuttle. The pattern going vertically and horizontally. The meaning is distinct of itself. So, for those of us who arrived on Tuesday, this is day 4 of our sesshin, and some of you arrived last night, and so this is the first day for you. And I'm very glad you could make it. Some of you have not been to sesshin before, and some of you have not been to one of our retreats before, and I'm very glad that you decided to take a risk and come here. I don't think you'll be disappointed. Basically, this koan has a conversation between Kaoshan and Elder De. Okay, and Kaoshan asks the elder, the Buddha's true reality body is like space. How do you explain this? And De says, it's like an ass, like a donkey, looking into a well. And Kaoshan said, that's a pretty good answer, but you're only 80%. And they said, what would you say? And Kaoshan said, it's like the well looking at the ass. So, you know, some of you have been doing koan for training with me for a long time. And people think that there are correct answers to the koan. And actually, that's not true. Basically, a koan is taking you on a journey. When the koan has taken you a little ways, basically I'll say, oh, very good, please keep going. And sometimes the koan hasn't been able to take you yet because you're resisting. And in that case, I might say, well, I think you're intellectualizing a little bit, which everybody does. It's not a knock. It's not a criticism. And then some people will come in and they'll present and they'll tell me where the koan has taken them. And I will say, oh, that's really very impressive. But I think you could go a little farther. And you might ask yourself, well, wait a minute, I've either answered the koan or I haven't. But notice that in this case, the teacher says, yeah, pretty good, but 80%. See, I don't usually give people percentages, but you get to, I'm not the only one who does this, in other words, right? It's not just me. It's like, well, that you've gone 80% of the journey I think the koan can take you. And sometimes I'll say, let's go one more day and just see if the koan can take you a little farther. Maybe you're at 100%. It's hard for me to gauge. He says, that's good, but 80%. And then we don't detect any hostility here, right, or irony. He says, what would you say, teacher? The Kaohsiung said, well, you know, here's the last step. So that's not so different from what I do. And I just wanted to clarify that, because some people might be confused. But if you haven't done Zen much, or you are still new to the process, the explanation I just offered might be as confusing as everything else in this story. So, you know, basically, in the modern world, we put huge amounts of faith in the power of the discriminating mind. And the discriminating mind can do amazing things, right? It can definitely do amazing things. So, you know, I myself have a metabolic disorder. And I have to take a pill every day to correct my metabolic disorder. And if I don't take it, you know, eventually I'll have renal failure. And if I take it, then I have, you know, the healthiest kidneys in town. But somebody invented this medicine, probably spent a career doing research and coming up with this amazing medicine. And it's also the case that, through the miracle of Zoom and the internet, we have been able throughout the whole pandemic to continue our vigorous practice schedule and even do, you know, five sesshin. We've done five sesshin entirely online. And this is our hybrid sesshin because in March when we planned all of this, we assumed that COVID was ancient history and now we would all be COVID-free and our masks we'd be putting our masks in the attic or donating them to museums. But it turns out that's not the case, you know, and so we're in a hybrid mode. And it's for those of you can see one of the panels, you know, and you've done sesshin here before, it's really nice to be back. On the other hand, it's really nice to be healthy, so if you were nervous about coming here, you made the responsible decision, and that's really important to be stay healthy and safe. So technology is wonderful, and the intellect is really an amazing thing. I was reading just before I came to sesshin that Leonardo da Vinci, his bridge, actually works. So some of you, I myself knew nothing about this. I knew that Leonardo da Vinci was a great Renaissance artist and actually engineer. And he did a design for a flying machine and something that looks like a helicopter. And also he did this bridge design for the Sultan in the Ottoman Empire called, he issued a RFP, you know, he wanted proposals, he called for proposals. This is true. And engineers all over the world gave him proposals for a bridge over the Bosphorus. And Da Vinci came up with this super grand bridge that, it's totally unlike any bridge design you've ever seen. It has, it just looks like a single piece of stone with no supports. It's just a self-supporting arch, very long and graceful and very tall. And everybody thought it was crazy, but actually some engineers at MIT have just tested it out and said, you know, this would actually work. So, who would have guessed? You know, super genius, you know, great intellect. And so, the discriminating mind is really wonderful and important, and knowledge is quite positive. But on the other hand, look where we are, as a society, we're in a still haunted by the fact that, you know, the most well-educated country in Europe, in the world, actually, in the 1930s, was Germany. And Germany, actually the United States, because of its large population and its excellent educational system, has gotten the most Nobel Prizes, you know. But actually, until after World War II, the Nobel Prizes mostly went to British and German scientists. The Germans had the most number of Nobels. And they had really some of the best universities in the world. And they also had, incredible philosophy and the arts. And this is where Nazi Germany really got a foothold and took off. And the thing is, a lot of the people who were involved in that were really good scientists, you know, and really good engineers. And even people of letters, you know, historians, even philosophers like Heidegger, you know. Heidegger was totally on board with the Nazis, right? Jung, to some degree. So, you know, we put this tremendous faith in the power of the discriminating mind. And I definitely don't want to say it's all a fraud, you know, that's crazy. But on the other hand, you know, reason isn't everything. And in fact, reason has to rest on like a foundation, on some kind of a foundation that isn't reason. And, you know, we don't really know in the West what it is. We don't have a good vocabulary for what it is. Because all we do is put our energy into reason, and science. You know, so I'm not knocking them. But what I am saying is, you know, they're not, like, enough. Because, you know, in Nazi Germany, all of those brilliant scientists, you know, were involved in developing better tanks, you know, the best tanks in the world, the best planes in the world. And you had logistical experts, you know, and so on, you know. They were all doing their rational thing. They were all doing their job really well. And the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And I think that's true for our society too, right? I mean, I don't know if you caught it in the news, but the IPCC came up with, I think it was his fifth or sixth statement about the state of the planet. And, it, you know, their intergovernmental panel that has to be diplomatic. It's full of diplomats. You know, the scientists talk to the diplomats, and the diplomats write it up. And the diplomats don't want to say anything that's going to offend their bosses, right? And their bosses are the government. So it's usually like really milquetoast, really watered down. You know, it's usually moderate. It's like the moderate view. And they always take like the middle of the road figures, and they never try to resort to alarmist language. And they never want to indict their bosses, right? They don't want to criticize their bosses. So they came up with this report. It's really shrill. It's really saying, we're screwed. You know, if we don't do something right away, we're screwed. And President Biden, whom I voted for and whom I'm pretty enthusiastic about, although I wish Bernie Sanders had won, but, you know, nevertheless, it's just me, right? I'm happy to have Biden, right? I think he's a good man, you know? And he gave a speech and he said, don't worry, by 2030, half the cars in the United States are going to be non-combustion cars. But, you know, actually, that's not nearly enough. You know, what we have is like a society that can't change its directions, you know, can't change directions, but it's not even able to be like fully aware of the he's making, you know, basically these turbines that are, you know, basically, you know, they use fossil fuels, you know. And he was like a star student at where he went to school. And out of college, he got a job right away. And he's a person of great integrity and intelligence. But, you know, he's just focused on his issue, which is like turbines, right? Making a better turbine. You know, and everybody's kind of like that. We're kind of locked into our, like, silos of whatever. We all have our interests, right? You know, and we all basically, you know, live, we use the training and education we have. And, you know, but the whole society, well, everybody's sort of like doing their thing in the way that society expects, right? You know, design engineers are designing turbines. You know, there are economists right now who are calculating this and that. There are, you know, while all of that's going on, you know, we have this crisis that we can't be, we don't seem to be able to respond to. And I think it's the way we experience the world. We have a lot of distractions like the internet and other things. But, you know, human beings create this world around themselves, like this imaginary world, and we're very good at it. And we create this imaginary world, and we're so good at it that it feels totally real all the time. And it's very difficult for information from outside of our imaginary world to come in and affect us. You know, and this is why I think all of those people in Germany who were really, you know, good scientists or good doctors or good lawyers, you know, a lot of them didn't quite take it in what was happening until it was like too late. You know, they were relying on reason, but reason is caught in the bigger collective fantasy, you could say. You know, so reason operates in this dream world we call reality, right? And in our dream world that we call reality, it's really important to say, get the latest car. Or it's really important to say, you know, the fall clothes are coming out. You know, there's a new look for fall. You know, he said, oh my God, I've got to put all my old clothes in the closet. There's a new look for fall. You know, and I myself do it. I have pants that are 20 years old, and they're cut very loose, and now all the style is like tight legged pants. So I put on my pants and I feel like I'm somebody from the 19th century, right? It's, you know, and I know I have to get some new pants, or my students will think, who is this guy? You know, he's like from another another generation, another century, right? So hopefully they'll come back in style, you know, in a couple of years. But right now I must get, you know, so my students won't laugh at me. But the thing is, you know, I'm trapped too in like this collective dream. One of the things I was reading the other day is, do you know that there's so much used clothes that nobody knows what to do with it? And it's like, there's huge, you know, everybody donates their used clothes to like, you know, the Salvation Army or one of these other organizations. And they actually mail them. And they do, they send them to other countries, but a lot of other countries say, enough, you know, we can't use anymore. We've manufactured so many clothes that we don't know what to do. It's actually like an environmental problem. You know, there's landfills full of like clothes that people wore a couple of years and threw away, right? So, you know, I think humans, and this is actually straight Buddhism, you know, humans create a world which has the matrix aspect to it, right? It feels totally real. And it has elements. elements of reality. It has elements of reality. You know, so yes, you know, clothes are objectively real. You know, when the temperature goes down, you need to wear a coat. You know, it's objective. You can measure the temperature. But not everything we do is really real, right? I mean, fashion isn't really real, right? The idea that, you know, a person needs more than three pair of pants is, you know, isn't really real, you know? All of that's kind of, that's where fantasy and reality sort of blend together to create this world. So you know, we believe that reason can liberate us, but, you know, reason itself is trapped in this fantasy. And another good example of this is what we've done in Afghanistan, which is so absolutely terrible, right? I mean, you know, my father was involved with the military, and he was in Vietnam. And, you know, my father associated with people who all, you know, had these degrees from the Kennedy School of Government, and they were super smart. And I was protesting the war. In fact, I got arrested once in Washington, D.C., and my father had to come and bail me out. And we had a huge argument in the car. And my father turned to me and he was like furious. And he said, listen, those people are a hell of a lot smarter than, you know, basically than you are. And they think the war is a good thing, you know. So he's right. You know, they were so smart, you know. They were brilliant and much smarter. It's now many years later, you know. I'm still not as smart as those people were. I admit it. But, you know, in another sense, they weren't smart at all. Or they weren't intelligent. They weren't intelligent. You know, they were smart, but not intelligent. So, you know, we're smart, but we aren't intelligent. How to be intelligent? That's the question. And intelligence isn't actually smartness. It's not something you can measure with a Stanford-Binet IQ test, right? You know, Zen is about being intelligent. And being intelligent means active. Is how do we get out of the collective dream? How do we get out of this collective dream? You know, when you see, like, whole countries going crazy, like we elected Trump, or, and I hope you'll forgive me, but India elected Modi, you know, when these kinds of things happen, you know, it's like all of a sudden, like, the madness behind the reason becomes obvious, right? It's like, well, wait, you know, we have a good public school system, we have the best, you know, we have Ivy League schools, how can Trump be president, you know, how can this happen? And it's because we live in a kind of dream world that we can't really get to what's outside of it. And one of the things that's outside of it is a global climate crisis, right? Another thing that's outside of it is the suffering of, like, people in Afghanistan, which we've kind of screened off from view. But in our personal lives, too, you know, we can feel like we're totally living in reality, and we can feel like we're proceeding with great rational clarity, and we can do terrible things, or we can make big mistakes anyway. We can hurt a lot of people and be self-destructive as well. So, you know, Zen is about being intelligent as well as smart, right? And that means getting in touch with this bigger mind that is deeper than reason. I said reason rests on a foundation that isn't reason. And, you know, reason is, you could say reason rests on a dream, which is our collective reality, and then the dream rests on something else. What does that rest on, right? And that rests on big mind. And Zen is about accessing big mind in order to have clarity. transcendental wisdom. It's transcendental because it comes from a place deeper than reason and deeper than the collective dream. And when we do zazen, when we do jhana, we are going to that place, but it's difficult to access because of our mental habits. So what we do is sit on the cushion, and for a couple of days of our retreat, we're still using those mental habits. We're still trapped by those mental habits. So if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's a koan. You go deep into emptiness, deep into wuxing, into shunyata. You go deep into emptiness, right? And emptiness is like below the level of thinking. It's below the level of the collective dream. So if there's reason, and that sits on the dream, and the dream sits on big mind, enlightened mind, see, it's like a stack. The door from, reason is on top of the dream, and then there's a door into the big mind, see? So if you dive down through reason in your mind, you go through reason, you go through the collective dream, all those fantasies that come up, all those emotions, those conditioned responses, diving lower, lower, lower through your mind, as we do zazen, you get to a door, and the door is mushin, shunyata, emptiness. See? And on the other side of that door is a big mind. And we learn how to wait patiently in order for that big mind to communicate to us through the door of emptiness. See? But the big mind, it will, if you trust the process. I'll give you a koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's like a logical contradiction. But your impulse is to try to work it out in terms of some meaning, which is a total waste of time, but everybody does it. And then when that's exhausted, right, you start like free associating. Things come up from your life or from the culture. Maybe you think of Gandalf with his pilgrim staff. You shall not pass, right? So that's not the answer either. So if you come in and you say you shall not pass, that will not get you the where you need to be. That's a cultural association. That's part of the collective dream. But you go to the door of emptiness and you wait for a response. And as you wait, it's actually very purifying. Patience, the patience of waiting. And gradually, the big mind begins to communicate to you. And the big mind can communicate. The big mind, the human brain is a little computer. This is like the big computer, right? The big computer. And the big computer will communicate with you if you wait at the door of emptiness. But the big computer doesn't speak in the English language or even Sanskrit or Mandarin. It speaks in the language of dreams, the language of dreams. And the language of dreams is not always clear, to us because we try to interpret it rationally. But, it keeps sending you signals, and after a while you get it, right? So, you're working on a koan, and your mind is totally blank, and it's day 3 of Sesshin, and all of a sudden, you start thinking about your brother and how you used to fight over toys and your toy chest, right? And you might think, well, what the hell? I'm going back to day 1 again. I'm wasting my time with these stupid issues that are 50 years old or 20 years old. And you push that aside, and then something else comes up, right? And something else. These are the big mind is speaking to you in the language of images, memory, pieces of memory, sometimes a word, right? Sometimes a word. You know, so it's like I don't know if anybody has ever played a game called Rebus, where there's pictures and the pictures suggest pieces of words. Well, this is not a Rebus, but the big mind is trying to communicate to you in its language, right? When I was a teenager, I fell in love with a girl, and it was like true love. And for a little while, we were like a we were like a thing. And she had black hair, beautiful black hair. And when she dumped me, it was really devastating. I think I was a little depressed, And I was really hurt by that. It took me a long time to be interested in romance again, Years later, at a sesshin, I was working on a koan, and I had this. I went to bed, and I had this dream where I was playing with this black dog. See, and the black dog was like so. Maybe when I saw the black dog, I was so happy, right? And I was just overjoyed. And I hadn't been that happy in the longest time. And then the black dog went away and I was sad and I woke up. And actually this was like a clue. This was like that feeling of loss was something I had to work on. The koan had taken me there again. I didn't realize at the time, but many years later, I realized, oh my God, that black dog was Susan, in my unconscious mind, she was a black dog that made me happy when I played with her, see? So that's what I mean by the language of dreams, so what you shouldn't do is get a dream book and try to interpret your dreams. Please don't do that. That's actually like a colossal waste of time. But what we do have to do is go into Wuxin, and then, it's an intuitive process. The big mind is trying to communicate with us in the language of dreams, or the language of the big mind, which is a supercomputer. So that toy chest is not necessarily a distraction, see? It's a message. But don't try to interpret it with your discriminating intellect. Just be with it. See, interpretation gets everything screwed up. So just be with what's coming up. Be with it. Be it. Be the toy chest. And sometimes things that come up are frightening, or they bring back difficult experiences, difficult memories, and so on. And you just have to be with them. You have to be with them. You actually have to become one with them. I talked about this a little yesterday. You have to be one with the things that frighten you. And then you're in this process, you're undergoing a transformation. You're being educated by the big mind. And the big mind isn't trying to give you information, it's trying to give you wisdom, which is opening up your mind to a bigger way of experiencing the moment. So, this koan talks about two aspects of Zen practice. It's like, when is he going to get to the koan? What about the donkey and the whale? Right? Basically, we start out like the donkey. We're the donkey. We go over to the well and we look down into the well. And that's where we are when we're starting to do Zen practice, where we're happy donkey, and we want to, we are starving, or we're parched, and we need water of life, right? And water is the mind, right? So we go over to the well, and we look down into the well, and at first, you know, we just see our reflection in the well, right, in the water. And that's, you know, who we think we are, who we think reality is. But, you know, that is the big mind. You know, that you look down in a well, and it's just a blank circle, like you're, like Mushi, right? And after a while, you start projecting onto the blankness, and you just sit with it, right? It exhausts all of your projections. And, you know, koan is like, like a magic stone, like a magic jewel. And we throw it down into the well, and it goes down, down, down into the well. And then, you know, the water starts bubbling, bubbling and boiling. You know, and you look in the well, and stuff starts coming out. That's the koan process. That's how we work through our obstacles, see? So in this koan, you know, basically, Kaoshan is asking an elder monk, he's sort of testing his insight. He says, basically, tell me about how we find wisdom. And the elder Day says, it's like an ass looking in a well, which is a pretty good, that's 80%, right? It's like a donkey looking down, you know, we are like donkeys looking down into a well. The well is the mind, right? At the bottom of, you know, at the bottom of the well, after getting rid of all the reason and all the collective dreams and so on, we get to this blankness. And that's how this guy understands. Practice that practice, that's a pretty good understanding. But, you know, the goal of Zen practice is ultimately right awakening, awakening. And awakening turns that around. It's like then we're not the donkey looking down into the well. We're the well looking up at the donkey. See, that's an enlightened mind. So, you know, because we are modern people, you know, we give 99 9/10 of our time to whatever, right? But not to this great matter of Zen, not to the great matter of the Dharma, not to the big mind. And in some cases, we have no choice. You know, we have to survive. You have to make a living. But as a result, you know, we sort of just go through our days, right? Until they're gone. But sometimes it becomes possible to practice Zen, and we start out looking into the well. And when we do, you know, we have these insights that can be very liberating and helpful. And you know, often the practice is just like that, right? It's better than not noticing the well, you know, and it's definitely helpful. And it's a wonderful thing, but we're still a little bit trapped, right? Because we're still, you know, living 99 9/10 of our life as the donkey, looking down into the well, and not as the well looking up at the donkey. But, you know, the Zen teaching is, the Buddhist teaching is that eventually there's like an inversion, right? Inversion. In Buddhist sutras, this is called revolution at the base. The great Vasubandhu, the great Vasubandhu called this revolution at the base. And that's where you stop identifying with your small self, and your baseline self becomes your big mind. And the small self becomes like a room you occupy on a trip, right? It's like a Motel 6 room, right? And that's after the revolution at the base of mind, revolution at the mind root. to not rule that out as a possibility, right? You never know if you keep practicing what will happen. And you can't control it. You just have to keep dropping your magical jewels into the well. And little by little, obstacles are removed, right? And eventually there's a revolution at the base and it turns around. And you're no longer donkey looking at well, you're now well looking up at donkey. And that's an awakened perspective. Kaohsiung asked Elder Day, the Buddha's true reality body is like space. It manifests form in response to beings, like the moon in the water. How do you explain the principle of response? Day said, it's like an ass looking into a well. That's pretty good. Kaohsiung says, yeah, that's 80. Good, that's about 80%. But, and then Day says, what would you say? Teacher, and Kaohsiung said, it's like well looking up at the ass. The ass looks at the well looks at the ass. Wisdom is all pervading, other aspects of reality, right? Both are aspects of reality. Purity pervades with abundance. Behind the elbow, who discerns the seal? In the house, notebooks are kept. The loom threads aren't strung. The work of the shuttle, the pattern going vertically and horizontally, the meaning is distinct of itself. So this poem is pretty tough. What he's really saying is this. It's possible to think that, you know, basically, there's an absolute separation between the donkey and the well. You know, the donkey's world is delusion and the well is enlightened mind. But actually, you know, that's a mistaken view too, because all of our perceptions are being created by the dream world we live in is also a product of enlightened mind. And that means that everything we can do, whether it's washing dishes or doing songs or, you know, practicing medicine, can give us access to the big mind. Everything. In the Mahayana, we say that there are 84,000 Dharma doors. Everything we hear, everything we see can take us to the mind, to the big mind. You know, to get my test, my COVID test, before I came, I got so frustrated because all of the CVSs, which advertise, you know, same day testing, were lying to me. You know, what a surprise. And I was, you know, calling all over the state of New Jersey. And so I finally went to a MedEmerge type thing on Route 22, and it was run by this wonderful Indian doctor. She is just running. She's retired. She said, I retired a couple of years ago. I'm 70 years old. I'm a pediatrician. And she said, but I was in retirement and I felt very unfulfilled. She said, this building used to be my one of my offices. And she said, now mostly I am administering COVID vaccines all over the state of New Jersey, mostly to homeless and homeless shelters. And she said, you know, I'm a pediatrician. I did a lot of work in Jersey City with people who are rather low income, often poor. And I've been knocking on their doors trying to get them to take the vaccine. You know, and I thought, this person is the Bodhisattva, you know, this is Avalokiteshvara, this is Guan Yin. You know, this person is the embodiment of compassion. You know, what an extraordinary person. And I, in my heart, I felt like, you know, getting down on my knees, but I didn't, because she would have, you know, called a please or something. But I said to her, you are a very unusual person, and it's like an honor. It's an honor to meet you. You are doing a wonderful thing for me. And so such people are in the world, and they may never have meditated. We don't know her story. I didn't ask. But, you know, everything we do can take us to wisdom if we make it a koan, if we use it as a way to access our big mind. So we're all here today to practice the great way. And everybody is doing a wonderful job. So we have a little time left. And this is a very precious opportunity to wake up. So let's use our time wholeheartedly.